A print celebration on the stack today. A master plan on making magazines. Why celebrated author Dave Eggers thinks the printed word is still the answer. And we speak to the editor-in-chief of the iconic National Geographic. Big names, big questions. It's a pretty big show today on the stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Today we'll hear from the editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine, talking about their forthcoming special issue dedicated to race, in which they look back on how the magazine's coverage of the theme has changed, and changed profoundly. We also get a profoundly positive view about print media from the acclaimed author and publisher, Dave Eggers. But first, we welcome into our studio MagCulture's Jeremy Leslie to give us an overview of his upcoming project, The Flat Plan, which is all about the art of making magazines, of course, and plenty more besides. Jeremy, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always good to be here. Thank you, Tom.
As always. So tell us, what's this Flat Plan all about?
Well,
a conversation had in magazine production areas, of course, across the world.
Absolutely. Well, it's the naming process, isn't it? The Flat Plan is actually, it's a masterclass in making magazines. And it's the result of, we do quite a lot of events and things involving magazines, and people are split into two groups. They're either there because they're really interested in the particular magazine being discussed, or they're there because they're interested in making their own magazine. They want to find out more, and they want to ask questions. And we keep getting asked these same questions. And so we wanted to provide a sort of fuller answer to people. So if someone's got a great idea for a magazine, they can come along and they can hear from a bunch of experts about A, how, and B, ask them all the questions they need.
And experts they certainly are, and you sort of reel off a few.
Yeah.
And they're magazines that you and I have talked about, mutual friends, people we admire, and certainly people who have, it's important to say, isn't it, a real mastery of their materials, the challenges of the medium.
So it's sort of divided into three sections. So I mean, we've called it dream, make and sell. So the idea is, we're looking for some inspirational talk, and we're looking for some practical talk, and then we're looking for some marketing promotional talk. So on the inspirational side, we're very excited to have Kirsten from MacGuffin come over, and a very complete and finished and excellent magazine. She's a very good talker about the project. And Danielle Pender has built her magazine Riposte up into a very successful project that is going from strength to strength. We're just finalising a lineup. There's another editor to be added to that. So that's the inspirational side. Then on the more practical side, we've got the managing director from Park Communications coming along to talk about print and the issues around that and how they can help you with that. We've got Sasha Simic from Central Books, one of the big London distribution companies, to talk about the real end result. I think that's something that a lot of people that set off in making magazines forget about, is I've made them all. I've got boxes of beautiful magazines, so happy, but now what do I do? And we're also very excited. For me personally, the design side's very important. And so from I Magazine, and indeed many other esteemed publications in his career, Simon Esterson will be talking about that aspect. And there are others. We're going to be announcing a big person who knows a lot about promotion and social media. And so hopefully the whole package will enable people to really get their ideas off the ground. And we hope to, you know, maybe in sort of 6 to 10 months, have some of these projects in our shop on sale.
And that would be super exciting. And I guess that's one of the questions I was going to ask you a little bit, which is, you know, in some ways, when people say, oh, you know, I've got a great idea, how do I get it off the ground? Do you have to sort of test the waters a little bit with people and check out, you know, are they really prepared, you know, ready for? Because it's not easy. And I think sometimes you can always look at a very polished, finished article and think, oh, you know, this, and people say, I threw this together in a few months. And it's not that easy.
Part of the joy of a great magazine is that it does look easy. You don't want to look at something and think, oh, gosh, how difficult.
See the joins.
As soon as you're in that, then there's something wrong with the magazine. The art of it is to make it feel like natural and easy and just an enjoyable piece of information, entertainment, whatever you want it to be. Mm. So, I mean, in terms of testing people, one of the first things I always say to people when they say, oh, well, I've got this idea for a magazine, I say, don't do it. Just don't go there. And you push them back. And then if they still keep going, you think, okay, maybe they've got a chance.
Because
it's hard work. A lot more hard challenges than asking me whether they could do it or not.
And that can be quite testing, of course, Jeremy. But on another serious point, it's interesting, you know, obviously you're talking there about this blend of experience and expertise from all the different facets of the whole process, including, as you say, right through to distribution, which people often, I think, practically have their finished product. Uh-huh. And then are like, oh, yeah. Is it possible to do a launch, and you know, a launch of a new magazine well, if you don't have a holistic approach, if you're not a bit of an expert at publishing models, you don't have half an eye on distribution? No, well, can it be just... Could you say, well, look, I'm just doing the art direction and I'll leave the rest to someone else? Is that, can you still sort of do that anymore?
I think you can build a team around you of people. I look at the example of something like the Migrant Journal. Justinian will tell you, the editor and founder will tell you, that he decided to make a magazine not because he wanted to make a magazine, but because he had something he wanted to communicate, and he decided that the magazine format was the correct channel to take forward. So he's learned along the way. So I don't think it's a matter of knowing it all, but it's a matter of having the right attitude in terms of being open to listen to advice, and also, where necessary, find the right people. So he brought in a design studio to help him with that. But, you know, he brings the magazines to the shop himself. He's doing the distribution himself, which, again, I think is, you know, it's a good idea to start with. Learn about it, figure out, and then when it comes to actually using a distributor, you'll know what you're paying for.
Well, let's broaden out the ambit of our discussion. We're going to cross over to New York. Jeremy, stay with us, because we're going to hear from the founder, the renowned author and editor, Dave Eggers. McSweeney's Publishing, set up in San Francisco back in the late 90s. The publishers helped launch the careers of dozens of emerging writers, Philip Meyer, Wells Tower, Rebecca Curtis, and the list goes on. Also publishing the works of well-established authors, Stephen King, David Foster Wallace, George Saunders, etc. A real impressive list. Monocle's Ed Stocker met Dave Eggers, and he wanted to find out from Dave why he is still so confident that it is a better time than ever for print right now.
McSweeney's is still chugging along, so that's always my bellwether. Like, if...
But it's been tough, no?
Well, we had... It hasn't been the fault of our subscribers and bookstores that sell it, and they've all been great. They've always stood by us. We have had Jobian levels of other issues, including the fact that I was never able to do math very well, and so I never really had any financial planning that went into it. And to be honest, it got a little too big at a certain point. You know, we had like 13 people working at McSweeney's at one point, which for us was just too much. So we're back down to 3. And that's the right scale, I think, for a small independent publisher to do everything and do it well. So we had some, you know, swings and misses here and there. We had some irrational exuberance, and we, but I think it's, I always say it's the best time in history to be an independent publisher, and mainly because there are no barriers to entry. If you wanted to pick up and start a publishing company tomorrow, it would take you a week, because you could produce a book on your laptop. I mean, you know, lay out a book that had been written. You could send it to a printer like we did in Reykjavik. They will print that book for you, and all you have to do, you pay the bill, and there are innumerable ways to get that book out into stores, and you can sell them through your own website and ship them directly. It's a very, very open field that, for the most part, runs on a gentlemanly kind of way of doing business, and the math is very simple for people that are better at math than me. So I think that I encourage everybody. Every week I meet some young publisher that's getting started. And I met a young woman last night at McNally Jackson, who was getting started doing her own company. And we talked about, I always try to warn people about pitfalls and what not to do and scale slowly and rationally and all that stuff. But I'm eternally optimistic. And the fact that we have done all that we've done, and for the most part, operated in the black about half the years that were around, and it means, I think it bodes well for others trying to do the same thing.
Do you recognize also the need sometimes to embrace the machine, as it were? I mean, your books have been published by big publishing houses. Books of yours have been turned into films, Hollywood films. How does that kind of duality work in a way?
I don't think you have to. I don't think you have to do any of those things necessarily. But for me, I'm interested in seeing what's going to happen sometimes. And so if somebody wants to adapt, I guess Hologram for the King was the first book that anybody adapted in mind.
With Tom Hanks.
Yeah. And, you know, Tom Tickford, who did Run Lola Run and Cloud Atlas, he called, and, you know, I thought it was incredible that this guy was going to actually turn this into a film. And he went to Saudi Arabia, and he almost filmed in Saudi Arabia, went to Morocco, and they spent, I don't know, maybe 6 to 9 months in Morocco setting up like these sets that looked exactly like the real places in Saudi Arabia that I had researched. And then Tom Hanks signs on, and, you know, it's one of those things that's beyond your imagining. In a short life, to have something like that happen, I just thought, you have to embrace it. And I got to go to the set in Casablanca for a couple of days and see, you know, see them at work a little bit. And then I don't like to spend much time on the set and get in the way. But, yeah, it's part of the balance, I think.
And the same for the books, right?
Yeah. You know, my books are now published by Knopf, which has been a really incredibly great relationship. I still publish some stuff with McSweeney's, and especially stuff that we want to get out a little quicker and idiosyncratic stuff that wouldn't be, you know, palatable by other publishers. But yeah, I think that dichotomy is sort of necessary, I think, to sort of, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I guess if I were to publish just my own books through McSweeney's, it would be tough for everybody financially. So you sort of need to work with Paul to pay Peter, I guess, is one way to put it. And
it's a way of reaching a bigger audience as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, McSweeney's is always going to be a small indie publisher without the capacity to, you know, do anything on a huge scale. We've just never had that kind of capital, and we don't have the reach. And there are companies that are just are much better suited to working on a bigger scale. And so when we take on a book at McSweeney's, we always tell the author, there are bigger companies out there and they might be able to reach a lot more readers, but we think that this book would be appropriate here. We think it's going to have an audience of a certain size, and we're going to publish it as well as we can. But it would probably be around this range. And we, you know, our range is about 5,000 copies. And if it exceeds that, that's great. But we think we do that scale, a book that otherwise might not find a home at a publisher, otherwise might not have a way into the world. We think we can do that really well and then give great attention to that book and make it look beautiful and keep it intimate. And, you know, the way that the author has real contact with their editor and, I mean, with all three of us that are there, or I'm four. I mean, there's only three people in the room, and I help out where I can. But I should say at this point, McSweeney's is three people. It's Christina Kearns, Claire Boyle, and Sun Ra Thompson, and that's it. And they do all the work, and I pop in and out if they need me. I can't take any credit for what they've been doing, and these guys were all interns at one time or another, and they run the place now, and they do it beautifully.
Eternally optimistic. He could be talking about you, Jeremy, the great Dave Eggers. But it is interesting, isn't it? And wherever you go in the world, and this again is a sort of narrative we've touched upon before, you do find that similar vigor, that readiness to tackle what there are still these rather sort of tedious other narratives about, well, it's under pressure and you can't make money in that and don't bother throwing good money after bad. And you can find the examples
there's a hunger. Yeah. And as we heard there, I think there is, Dave was talking about, I think primarily books, but the same in magazines. There's a very supportive network of people that will help you, which is, going back to the flat plan, is kind of what these people are coming together on that day to do.
Well, let's go back to the flat plan then. We heard some of the details before we heard from Dave Eggers. Tell us a little bit about how people can get involved. Where's the details?
Details are all on the website, of course, magculture.com. It takes place on Saturday, the 14th of April. It's all day. All the details are online in terms of, and we'll be adding some more names. It's quite a complex program, but we hope it'll deliver a really exciting, inspirational, but practical day. It'll be a long day, but it'll be worth it.
Very good. And well, and again, another sort of metaphor for the process of making a magazine.
If you can make it through a day with Jeremy, you can
achieve anything. And Jeremy, it was also good to acknowledge the fact that you've got some subsidised places that you've taken care of as well for the students and the rest.
The deadline for that's already passed, but yes, we have three free places for people under 23, and we've got some very exciting entries to that. We've just been in touch this week with the people that have won, and so we're looking forward to welcoming them as well.
The next generation.
I hope so.
I like it. And more
doing as well.
Yes,
that's the important thing.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of which, we crossed stateside, of course, to hear from Dave Eggers a bit earlier, and you're talking about all sorts of exciting developments. And lo, there is more.
There is more. So I'm just back from New York, and I had a very exciting series of meetings. We just announcing now that we're going to do an edition of our conference, Modern Magazine, in New York this spring, 30th of May. We're partnering with Parsons School of Design and AIGA New York, the designers, the graphic design organisation out there, and we will be presenting a full day's ModMag, as people in London are familiar with. I'm very excited about that. We always bring a few American guests over to the London edition, so we're looking to invert it, and we'll rely on our local contacts in New York to build a programme and then bring some people from London and Europe to mix it up a bit. So very
exciting.
It's
super exciting. I hear that
news soon.
And have you, of course, shared in Monocle Towers this idea of, you know, getting out in front of people, connecting these interested international communities and taking them overseas. You know, we have our conferences and the rest, and it's just such a brilliant conduit to again to be active and proactive about, you know, we can sit here and kick these ideas around, but to get out there and do it is so exciting.
Last time I was here, I was saying one of the things I wanted to do this year, the kind of message underlying everything, is to try and get magazines and magazine making in front of people that maybe are going to be surprised by what's going on. And so this is what all these projects are about.
Fabulous. Well, more power to you, Jeremy. Good to hear about so many exciting things, and our listeners can find you on all of your usual channels. Keep us posted. Look forward to hearing more.
Will do. Thanks for having me.
Finally on the programme this week, it's time to talk National Geographic. This week, the editor-in-chief, Susan Goldberg, published an editor's letter about their forthcoming edition dedicated to the theme of race. In the letter, Goldberg admits that for decades the magazine's coverage has been racist, and they have to acknowledge that. We're going to hear from Susan in just a second, but first, here's Monocle's Toronto bureau chief with his view on the magazine, and indeed of Susan Goldberg herself. Tomos Lewis interviewed her on our show, The Big Interview, last year. Here's Tomos.
There's obviously a nostalgia that exists to those yellow spines on the bookshelves of aunties or uncles or grandparents, wherever in the world you are. And I think balancing that sense of nostalgia with actually being a very current and a very real kind of source of news is something that National Geographic takes very seriously. I think what's interesting about the forthcoming race issue, I suppose, comes in a similar vein to the landmark edition of the magazine they published last year, which was devoted entirely to issues of gender. Now, this came out just after the election of Donald Trump, just after the inauguration, in fact. And of course, this was a time where notions of gender, conversations of gender, were really very alive and very real. We'd just had the first realistic, I suppose, a contender for president, a woman, defeated by arguably the most misogynistic contender for president in the US is history politically. And the way that National Geographic approached these conversations, which are still alive today, you think of the residue of the women's marches, the notions of the Me Too movement, so-called. The way National Geographic approached that was not to offer a political commentary, but was to unpick both the science, unpick the sort of social anthropological factors at play in these stories, and to allow readers to make up their own mind from there. I think the fact that Susan Goldberg sees National Geographic as having a largely digital future is interesting. It will worry many. I think she told me herself that they are looking at maybe making the print product a more premium product in the years to come. I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think that the National Geographic brand is such a potent one still. And I think that, especially under Goldberg's leadership, there is this sense of responsibility that good stories told well and financed, you know, newsrooms cutting budgets everywhere, but putting the money up to send people to places to view and live these stories firsthand still has a great value, especially in the times we're in. And it'll be interesting to see the kind of conversations, I think, that the race issue, particularly in the United States, really brings to be, because the kind of conversations that surround race, surround immigration, surround the notions of the other, as Susan Goldberg said, really are some of the most potent conversations I think many corners of US society have engaged in for some time.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Next up, let's hear from Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He spoke this week to Susan Goldberg. Here they are.
We decided about a year and a half ago that we would do a special issue devoted to the subject of race. And we decided to do that for a few reasons. First, it seems like race is at the center, unfortunately, of so many of the conversations going on in the United States and around the world, and mostly it's the ways that race is used to divide us. It does just seem like this is what everybody is talking about, almost no matter what other topics, race topics get involved in those conversations. So that seemed like one reason we should do this issue. The other was that April 4th of this year marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., you know, the most important civil rights leader ever in the United States, I think it's fair to say. And it seemed like a good time to step back and take stock, really, of where are we on race? How far have we come to the goals that Dr. King promulgated and pushed so hard for? So those were the reasons that we decided to do the issue. And the issue really is just kicking off an entire year of coverage around race and diversity. We'll also have stories coming up about Muslims and Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans. And our story also starts with a scientific and sort of evolutionary and biological look at what race is and what race isn't.
And Susan, at the same time, you looked back at the magazine's history, you know, very proud history, but at the same time, you noticed that there's been some problem with the past coverage. You know, sometimes you even said it was almost a bit racist, the coverage as well. So are you trying to look into that as well, some sort of, even in an apologetic way?
Well, I thought that if we were going to do a story about race, that we also needed to look at the history of how National Geographic has covered race. And that's because I've heard from so many readers in my job that National Geographic was the first time they'd ever really noticed people or communities or things outside of their own lives, right? We took people around the world. And so, you know, the authenticity of that storytelling is very important. And when we cover issues like race that are so fraught, being credible is even more important than that. I thought that to be credible in our coverage of race, before we started looking at everybody else, maybe we needed to look a little bit at ourselves. And so I asked a historian from the University of Virginia, John Edwin Mason, to help us look into our archives and tell us our own story.
And which type of stories did you deem they were a bit problematic and that perhaps, you know, since you've been editor or of course, you know, since the 70s, it's been changing?
Yes, I mean, the good news here is that, you know, since the 1970s, our coverage has changed a lot. But when you look before the 1970s, you see a publication really reflecting the views of an elite white majority. You see a publication that began actually at the height of colonialism, and it reflects the views of the colonizers and the colonized, and you do see how that plays out on the pages. You know, you see some language that certainly we would never use today, but mostly I think you just get a view of the world just through an elite white lens rather than, you know, a view that was more inclusive of the voices of the people who were being covered. Now, happily, I would say that has changed completely in the years, certainly since the civil rights movement, where, you know, of course we are including the voices of the people who we're covering, and increasingly we're making sure that the people telling those stories are people who really understand the communities that they're covering.
Well, talking about that, you even mentioned in your editor letters a story about Haiti that I believe you've done in 2015. Would you mind telling us a bit more about that story?
Sure. In 2015, we decided to go to Haiti, which we have been to many times. This time, though, we decided to do it a little bit differently. And we put cameras in the hands of a group of young Haitian photographers we were working with, and we asked them to document life in Haiti because they're going to see and be able to document their own lives in a way that outside photographers probably wouldn't. Now, happily, the photographer we had on this assignment has been to Haiti many, many times and has done an incredible job and loves Haiti and has spent a great deal of time there. But I thought it was an important element also to see the documentation of the young Haitian photographers too, taking us into their own lives in a way that, you know, none of us really would have access to otherwise. I'm very proud of that. I mean, one thing that I hope doesn't get lost in this conversation is that National Geographic has a really proud history in many ways. I mean, we sent explorers and scientists and researchers and writers and photographers all over the world and really brought the world home to people in a way they had never seen it before. And that is a part of our past that we're very proud of and that continues to, you know, set a high bar for us today. But, you know, I did think it was important on the topic of race in particular to look at where had we done it well, but also where had we not done as well as we should have.
And Susan, the race issue, you know, the April 2018, will it be, you know, in collaboration with the other National Geographic titles around the world, or is this mainly for the U.S. edition?
Well, we do publish in 33 languages, and the way it works is that our editors in those other countries can decide what they want to put on their own covers and what content they decide to use. They also produce some of their own content. So what I'm hoping, and I haven't seen what everybody's doing yet, is that, you know, a lot of people will run the stories about the science of race, because those are really global stories. We've also got a story about humankind's propensity since the dawn of time to look at people who aren't like us and label them as the other. And why is that? So there are at least two very global stories in this issue. The other stories are more United States focused, but I'm certainly hoping that our overseas editions will use at least a few of the stories about race and then perhaps even produce some of their own content.
And Susan, we're here a show that values print media, The Stack. I'm a huge, always been a fan of National Geographic. In terms of the print products, you know, the magazine, do you still see people like valuing the print and going buying their monthly edition?
Oh, absolutely. We have, you know, about 54 million readers of our print issue around the world. And so I don't think it's, you know, it's not going anywhere anytime
soon.
But I hear from people all the time how much they love holding the magazine, touching the magazine, collecting the magazine, saving the magazine. They have walls full of yellow-spined magazines. So I do. I hear from people all the time about that. But, you know, that said, it is probably ultimately a digital future. But I think that, you know, what I really love is the combination of the immediacy of digital storytelling that we can do. And the way we can bring maps and graphics and photos to life on digital platforms, but then also have the beautiful, eternal wonder of holding a magazine in your hands.
Susan, a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, that was a pleasure. I'm a big fan of National Geographic, and I think you're doing a great job, and I look forward to see the race issue as well.
Terrific. Well, it'll be, you know, it's starting to be available digitally now and then more on newsstands by the end of the month.
And that's all we have time for on this week's program. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome, of course. Do get in touch with Fernando. You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.